Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. 1 year ago today, the community of Grizzly Flats was in the direct path of 150-foot wind-driven flames chewing through a dense, overgrown forest that had long been a huge threat. That threat became a reality when the Caldor fire ignited on August 14th, 2021. 2 days later, 1 year ago exactly from today, it reached the town of Grizzly Flats. The fire moving fast. Here's some of what the radio traffic sounded like as the call was made to evacuate the area.
Start the evacuation process of Grizzly Flats.
10-4 for an order. 79 engine 338, engine 2774, engine 389 to the community of Grizzly Flats. A Caldor incident.
Again, that was a year ago today. After the smoke cleared and the wildfire marched towards Myers and South Lake Tahoe, more than 400 of Grizzly Flats' 600 homes, that's over two-thirds, were destroyed. The Caldor fire would eventually destroy over 1,000 buildings and was officially fully contained more than 2 months after it started. Around that time, about 9 months ago, Cap Radio and the California Newsroom, a collaboration of public radio stations, NPR, and CalMatters, teamed up to investigate the Caldor fire. They found the U.S. Forest Service knew Grizzly Flats was at risk nearly two decades ago and had a plan to protect the town. But only a fraction of the work was done. Joining us is the team that worked on the investigation. Cap Radio State Government reporter Scott Rodd, Cap Radio Data reporter Emily Zentner, and the California Newsroom's data journalist George Levines. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you so much for having us on.
Scott, starting with
you.
Welcome, everyone. Scott, starting with you, take us back a year ago. You covered the Caldor fire. You were in the community of Grizzly Flats. What happened to the town?
Well, you know, it started off pretty slow. The Caldor fire burned through dense forest for a couple days, and then it really picked up. The winds sort of pushed these flames out, spread across thousands of acres of national forest land. And the fire grew to one of the largest, most destructive fires in California history. You know, it destroyed stretches of forest, destroyed many homes. In those early days, as you said, a year ago today, the flames entered Grizzly Flats. I mean, not just entered, but really barreled through the town. It destroyed most of the town's 600 homes. And today, you know, a lot of the town kind of looks like a moonscape. There's a lot of areas that have been clear cut that were once, you know, dense green forests. You have trees that remain that look like spent matchsticks, basically burned top to bottom. And a lot of the homes that were once standing are now just cleared foundations.
Yeah, I was actually driving through that area last week and just saw foundation after foundation after foundation and very little homes. But when driving through the area, I mean, there's a lot of windy roads. It's very much rural country. Can you describe the terrain surrounding Grizzly Flats?
Yeah, Grizzly Flats is between Sacramento and Lake Tahoe, and it's surrounded on three sides by the El Dorado National Forest. And, you know, this is densely forested, rugged country, steep mountainous canyons over, you know, deep river drainages. And so it's a beautiful place, really is, but it's not for the faint of heart. This is an area that requires a certain commitment and self-sustaining lifestyle in order to live there. You know, you have to be prepared for powerful winter storms. You have to be prepared to dig or plow yourself out, or in the case of during the summer, you have to be prepared for dangerous wildfires potentially.
And it wasn't just residents, but the Forest Service was aware of the risks to this community. They recognized the risk to the town of Grizzly Flats. What did they do to warn residents?
So 20 years ago, the Forest Service held a meeting in the town church, and they warned residents that they were essentially sitting in the crosshairs of Mother Nature. I spoke to resident Mark Almer. He attended the meeting 20 years ago, and it's pretty chilling to hear him recall what happened that day.
They showed a PowerPoint presentation. It was a fire modeling of what could happen if a fire started on Forest Service land in the drainage of the middle fork of the Cosumnes River. It showed that if a fire started down there, it would take out Grizzly Flats within about 24 hours. Well, 20 years later, that's pretty much exactly what happened.
And so the Forest Service basically predicted that ignition and burn path of the Caldor fire. The Caldor fire started in the drainage of the middle fork of the Consumnis River. In a way, you have to give credit to the Forest Service for acknowledging that this risk was there and warning the residents that this was a reality. You know, Almer wound up leading the helped co-found and later led the local Fire Safe Council. They were very active. They focused on education, helping people with defensible space. They did a lot of fuel reduction projects around the community. But, you know, their scope was limited. They were all volunteer. This was a small community. And they were really depending on the Forest Service to also protect Grizzly Flats, again, because it was surrounded on three sides by the El Dorado National Forest.
Okay, so that was in the early 2000s. Fast forward to 2021, that foreshadowing tragically came to fruition. Between then and 2021, that's about 20 years. What was the Forest Service plan to protect Grizzly Flats?
Well, it took them about a decade to develop a comprehensive plan. It was called the Trestle Project. It was about 15,000 acres of commercial tree thinning, which is when you remove some trees and you sell them for lumber or wood pellets. It also planned a lot of prescribed burning, which is intentional low-intensity fire to kind of to put the land back in check, essentially, to reintroduce fire in a natural way or mimicking a natural way. And this project was designed to protect Grizzly Flats, specifically from wildfire. Leading up to the introduction of this project, the Forest Service did tackle some projects around Grizzly Flats, but a lot of it was scattered and deep in the woods. The Trestle Project was really supposed to be this kind of resilient buffer around the community.
George, I want to bring you in. You're a data reporter with the California Newsroom, and were really instrumental in kind of piecing together this investigation when it came to what the Forest Service actually completed in this plan. What did you learn?
Yeah, first, before we dive into the data, the initial completion date was set for 2020, and a host of factors.
So a year before the Caldor fire.
Yes, correct. A year before the Caldor fire, right. But a host of delays pushed back that completion date to as late as 2032, which is a full three decades after that initial meeting in Grizzly Flats, where the Forest Service warned the town. There were several reasons for the delays. Pushback from environmentalists and activists wanting to protect the spotted owl are primary ones. So the approval for the project was in 2017, but then very little work got done, and the data analysis that we performed showed that of the 15,000 acre project, only about 14% was completed at the end of the day, before the Caldor fire, you know, ripped through Grizzly Flats. Most of that work was commercial tree thinning, so cutting down trees for sale, for lumber, and for making pellets, things like that, which most experts that we talked to agree that alone has a pretty limited effectiveness on the impacts of a wildfire when it does come through. Basically, none of the 10,000 acres, so about two-thirds of the project, was designated as the low-intensity understory burning that Scott described earlier. Again, what experts say, kind of agree, is most effective in terms of mitigating the effects of a wildfire, at least when it comes to comparing it to commercial thinning. But almost none of that work got done.
And your data found that just 14% of the 15,000 acres in that project that initially was scheduled to be completed in 2020, a year before the Caldor fire, actually was accomplished. Scott, when you showed these findings to experts, what did they have to say?
Well, you know, we talked to wildfire experts as well as former Forest Service officials and career firefighters who, you know, have seen these fires firsthand. And many of them said Grizzly Flats would have had a better chance of withstanding the Caldor fire if the Trestle Project had been completed. We spoke to Michael Wara, a climate and wildfire policy expert from Stanford University. He reviewed our findings, and this is what he said.
It's really sad to see this. It's sad to think about what could have been, right? If all this work was done by 2020, Grizzly Flats might still be there.
And then there's Dwayne Nelson. He's a retired Placerville District Ranger in the El Dorado National Forest, which is under the Forest Service. He was a key architect of the Trestle Project. I spoke with him about the Trestle Project and the work that had or hadn't gotten done, and here's what he had to say.
I think that of all of the timber sale units have been treated and all of the 11,000 acres of prescribed underburning had been done, I think there would have been a very high probability that Grizzly Flat would not have burned in the Caldor fire. It could have meant survival.
So Nelson retired in 2017, just as the Trestle Project was approved and they were about to get work underway on the ground. He told me that he cried most nights watching the Caldor fire burn through his former district. He said he was proud of the work that they had done on the Trestle Project, proud of the plan itself to protect Grizzly Flats. But he says, you know, there was much more that still needed to get done by the time the Caldor fire ignited.
You also spoke with the Forest Service. What was their reasoning what were their reasons for why they didn't complete this project?
So they offered a number of reasons why, and we mentioned a couple earlier. There was pushback from environmentalists with concerns about this project, and it took years to address those and ultimately develop alternative maps that sort of met most people's concerns. There's also the issue of staffing shortages. The Forest Service has perennially had problems with retaining staff, especially on the fire side of things. Climate change is another one. It's made doing prescribed burning much harder. The window to do that where the right weather, the right air quality and conditions line up, as well as having personnel, that's really challenging. And then climate change is also making fires more extreme. So the personnel that is there often gets pulled off to go work these fires for days and weeks on end. But the biggest issue, they said, was funding. Here's Chief Randy Moore. He leads the Forest Service. We spoke to him about this issue just a few weeks ago.
You know, let's not make any bones about this. It's funded. We did not have the funding to do the level of work that needed to be done out there. These fires are destroying a lot of our communities in these small towns. And that's why it's so critical to really look at trying to multiply the number of fire sheds that we're treating, the number of acres that we're treating, because we know what's at risk.
And I should say, we spoke to Chief Moore about a week ago. Time flies when you're digging into a project like this. He's the highest ranking Forest Service official currently. And from 2007 to 2021, he was the highest ranking Forest Service official in California before he was appointed by Joe Biden. And that appointment came just a few weeks before the Caldor fire ignited. Moore said he's optimistic that there are billions of dollars that have been allocated by Congress under the infrastructure law and now what's coming with the Inflation Reduction Act. But he declined to weigh in on whether what happened with the stalled Trestle Project could have made an impact in Grizzly Flats. Here's part of our exchange.
Does the Forest Service bear any responsibility for the outcome in Grizzly Flats?
Well, I mean, I don't know what kind of question that is. I mean, you know, do anybody bear any responsibility for not having a budget to do the work that we need to do out there to treat these conditions that we see on the ground? You know, it's easy to point a finger at one entity.
And I should note, we asked several more times, but Moore did not want to comment either way on that question.
Emily, I want to bring you in because you worked on mapping out the planned and completed treatments, and those visuals really take this data and information to another level, and you can't help but think what could have been if this project was completed. What does looking at these treatments on a map tell us about the impact they could have had on the Caldor fire?
Well, after what you heard of Chief Moore's response, we can't say what the impact had been. The Forest Service declined to comment on what they felt like the impact could have been. And fire behavior is unpredictable, so it's not a clear yes or no answer. But what we can see on the map, we were talking about this earlier, is really clear to me. This treatment area that was supposed to be treated was not just directly between the origin point of the fire and Grizzly Flats, but it was like a wall across the early growth of the fire. So I think that there's a lot that we can understand looking at that about what possibilities could have existed had this been completed. And, you know, I think there's a lot of questions there because it really was a protective barrier that just was not completed.
Yeah. And we're talking about just the initial days of a wildfire that spanned 2 months until being fully contained and continued. It crested the summit and it went into the towns of South Lake Tahoe and Myers. Let's pull back the curtain a little bit. I mean, your wheelhouse is data. How did we get the data?
So this data was provided by the Forest Service, and part of the reason we had to have it given to us by them was that there were some issues with the public-facing data, which George can get into a bit later, but the Forest Service had to provide us a cleaned-up version because their public data set was not accurate for us to use. But it's not as simple as just going onto that public data set and downloading and knowing that everything's there, because things are entered and not entered sort of haphazardly. And this is something that comes up a lot with fire data. And we got a response from the Forest Service that is something I've heard a lot, which is just if we have to choose between having someone entering data and having someone out doing work, we're going to choose them going out and doing work. And so we see this a lot with fire data, that it's sort of all over the place sometimes.
Yeah. All right, George, well, talk to us about the inconsistencies in the Forest Service data.
Sure. Yeah. So one of the main things, we submitted our methodology when I went through and did all these calculations. I basically wanted the Forest Service to vet them to make sure I was getting it right. And when we did that, they came back and said, you know, the methodology looks good. However, in reviewing your findings, we actually found that there are some projects in here, some treatments that are marked as completed that were never actually completed. And so that's how we got to the 14% figure. Originally, I had come in around 24%, and they came back with this corrected data for us. So kudos to them for being transparent about that. I would also say that, kind of as Emily mentioned, the consistency and hygiene across jurisdictions can vary pretty widely. One jurisdiction was telling us use column A to calculate your acreage. Another jurisdiction told us no, use column B. Some forests track their planned projects in the database, some do not. So all of that, you know, kind of was a lot of back and forth to really getting to the most accurate picture we could paint of the Trestle project. I should also say that we went back 15 years to consider work that was done prior to the Trestle project, excuse me. And we found that the Forest Service, within a 5-mile buffer of the town of Grizzly Flats, had completed about 15,000 acres worth of work. So about the same size as the Trestle Project was originally planned to be, just by coincidence. But the majority of that work was beyond 3 miles, so set pretty deep away from the town, but work that, you know, is due credit because it does have an impact and does matter.
And when you got a clearer picture, I mean, I think what underscores just another challenge is, you know, numbers are nothing without context. How does the Forest Service count and quantify its wildfire mitigation work?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And it's one that the Forest Service has been taking to task for the past couple decades. Basically, the database that we were using and that the Forest Service provided data to us from, it's a database of work and not necessarily area. So when they execute a particular type of treatment, they'll enter a record into the database. And oftentimes, some of those treatments are preliminary, requiring follow-up treatments. So when they go back for those follow-up treatments, they enter another record into the database on that same exact geographical area. Now, they have to do this because they need to track all the work that they're doing. But at the same time, when they go to report out totals, it can create the illusion that they're treating many more acres than the actual footprint on the ground. So again, long criticized for this practice, but a tricky situation for them too, to track all the work that they're doing and present an accurate representation of the area being treated.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about a CAP Radio and California Newsroom joint investigation into the Caldor fire from last year and why a U.S. Forest Service project to help protect the community from a devastating wildfire fell short. Scott, you traveled up to Grizzly Flats. You talked to residents there. What was their reaction to the plan and the failure of implementing the plan?
You know, there's definitely some frustration for sure. I spoke to Kathy Melvin. She was a longtime member of the Fire Safe Council, and she lived on the south side of Grizzly Flats for 40 years, and she shared a border with the Forest Service. And I should note that the south side of Grizzly Flats is where the fire entered the community. It's actually identified as first priority for this work to get done. It ultimately didn't. Ms. Melvin ended up losing her home. And so here's what she had to say about the work or lack of work that she saw by the Forest Service over the years.
The history of the Forest Service in the time that we lived there was that everything took forever. It would take years and years and years for anything to get done.
And again, she could see out her back window whether or not work was getting done, and it wasn't. The Forest Service land just remained overgrown, and she said basically, you could barely walk through it. She's not rebuilding in Grizzly Flats. She unfortunately lost her home of 40 years. She ended up buying a home in Natomas, just outside of Sacramento, or I should say in Sacramento. And she's holding on to the property, though. She says maybe her children may want to rebuild there one day.
When it comes to residents who want to rebuild in Grizzly Flats, how are they moving forward?
There is still a lot up in the air. It's unclear how many people will return. There's concerns. There's been ongoing concerns about folks in Grizzly Flats trying to get money from FEMA. There's obviously the persistent ongoing question of fire insurance and whether or not people have it and what it will cover. Some people are starting to rebuild, and those who are returning are really showing just an incredible resilience. Victor Diaz and his family, they lost everything in the fire. Now, Victor, his wife, their six children, eight of them, are living in an RV, and they've been in that RV since December, living on the property right next to where the wood frame of their new home has just gone up, about 50 feet from this RV they've been living in. Here's what he said about rebuilding.
Yeah, we just count the days. We keep watching it from there, and it's like, wow, you know, it's just exciting. It's incredible to see it. You know, the foundation, and then you start seeing it coming back to life. It gives me hope every single time I look at it. It's like just so grateful to God that I have somewhere to live, that I'm able to see it, because it really seemed impossible. Like it seemed impossible.
And, you know, I think Victor's story is a testament to just how strong this resilience is from people who are returning to Grizzly Flats. You know, living in this RV, it's powered off of a generator. He's had to, you know, clear this generator out from snow after massive winter storms. They can only cool one side of the RV with this tiny generator during hot, sweltering summer days. So it's just incredible to see what families like the Diazes and others have been able to push through and persist through up in Grizzly Flats.
And the reality is Grizzly Flats, there are so many countless communities that face a similar risk. And it wasn't the only town that the U.S. Forest Service deemed a priority. And it's not only the Forest Service, there's public land that's managed by the state and local communities as well. I'm just curious, what do you want listeners to take away from this investigation? Emily, I'll start with you.
I think for me, you know, we can see the Forest Service had this plan and this intention to create this barrier. And so the question that I come away from this with, and something that I think we all just need to think about a little bit more deeply with climate change and just the current situation, is how do we get this work done? Why is this work not getting done? And how do we solve those problems and create a system where we can manage this land in a way that's more protective?
Yeah. George?
Yeah, I would say that the Forest Service has a monumental task, and it's extremely complicated work when you consider all the modeling and factors that they're up against. And to go back to the budget, you know, the hazardous fuels reduction budget to the mitigation budget has barely increased over the last years compared to the suppression budget. So they've really got their work cut out for them, and it'll be interesting to see how the country moves forward.
Scott, what do you want listeners to take away?
I would definitely echo what both George and Emily said. You know, there's a recognition that this work needs to get done. There's a recognition of the problem. And in the case of Grizzly Flats and the Trestle Project, a plan that's laid out. So trying to figure out how are we going to get this work done? You know, we recognize the problem. How are we going to reach the solution? I think that's a big takeaway. And it's a big question mark. And experts are saying we don't have time to waste on this. And the other thing that I would say is a big takeaway is just that, you know, these communities, after a fire burns through and destroys many homes, you know, when the fire passes through, that's not the end of it. Often that's just the beginning of the struggle. And seeing what the folks of Grizzly Flats have had to go through in the last year is just remarkable. And the resilience is incredible. So just a reminder that when a fire passes through a community, there is struggle that continues and perhaps even surpasses the struggles of the day that the fire burned through. Those persist, and there are folks still out there trying to put their lives back together.
That is Cap Radio State Government Reporter Scott Rahn, Cap Radio Data Reporter Emily Zentner, and the California Newsroom's Data Journalist George Levines. Thank you all for joining us today and sharing your investigation.
Thanks, Vicki.
Thank you, Vicki.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.